Well, hey ho, everybody.
That was so cowboy. Maybe I have Montana on the brain.
I was just going to say. Thing I just noticed in our rundown, the name of this music is The Informant. Anyway, hi, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, the show where Kai reads the rundown in real time. Where we connect the dots between stories about the economy, tech, and culture that you see in the news every day. Oh, dude, I am famous for, has that building always been there?
It's that glimpse behind the scenes. We, by which I mean Molly, are going to talk to Lydia Polgreen today, the editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, about her new vision for that site and how media sites really in general can help bring people together instead of, as seems to be happening quite a bit lately, driving them further apart. Farther? I don't know. Somebody write in and tell me. Driving them apart. How about that? Without any modifier.
Good to you. And hope springs eternal on that one, by the way. Not the email, but the media sites bringing people closer together. Full disclosure, I will be out of town spring break when this episode goes live. So we are going to have a newsless news fix about the news because we have learned that you can't even predict the news, you know, the day before, let alone the week before. So God only knows what's happening at this exact moment as you are listening to the show.
Pandemonium is what's happening. We're going to take a big picture look at today's media landscape. Here we go.
David Esrati sent us this comment a while ago, and I hope I said that right. It is a great kickoff to this discussion.
My father was a journalist, a copy editor, and would tell me it was his job to fact-check and protect the special privilege of the Fourth Estate's integrity, making sure that their trust and respect was above reproach. While I still believe that there are journalists like you that strive for those same lofty goals, I now know that listeners, readers, news consumers all bring their biases to the table and pick and choose what fits their own values, thereby upsetting even the most fair and balanced reporting out there. Knowing this doesn't make me smarter, but it does make me better understand the challenges we face when everyone is now an expert, and amateur content can be on the same playing field as what was once relegated to respected professionals.
Yes. I mean, you know, right? That's totally right. And I think a lot of what's going on in this country today is about, but also because of the media. How about that? Writ large. That's a very large contextual thing to say.
It's really interesting because I think so many of these trends come down to economics. Like once the economics of journalism changed so profoundly that, you know, news outlets just increasingly congregated on the West Coast, that they consolidated in order to make more money and laid people off and started doing sort of like reporting from afar, the West Coast and the East Coast. Sorry, the coasts is what I meant to say. And then that all of that combined with kind of with the rise of the internet. And I was thinking actually about Tim Wu, one of our first guests, whose book was called The Attention Merchants. And he pulled together kind of threads that we've been talking about for several shows in a row, which are data collection, but also the need to grab your attention at any cost, which started in media with 24-hour news.
Sure.
And then only got worse when it got online and you had to stand out and you had an entire news economy briefly built up around clickbait.
Right. Not what briefly? It's still, come on, there's still so much out there that's clickbaity garbage.
Well, yeah, there is, but major media supposedly, like BuzzFeed, you see BuzzFeed try to pivot from listicles to real news, and it's not to say that they're not doing real news, but the fact is now the trust is completely confused. It's like, what are you for?
Right. BuzzFeed is an interesting example because there are some journalists there who do really good and worthwhile stuff, right? That contribute to the national dialogue. And then there's all that stuff that makes me feel guilty about going on BuzzFeed because it's like, why am I wasting my company's time doing this at 9:30 in the morning on a work computer? You know?
Right. And what does it take to get your attention?
Right.
And, you know, whether that's BuzzFeed or anybody else. And so digital media companies are funded by advertising.
Right, right.
So that makes them need to collect your data. I mean, journalists have been getting paid per click, period.
Yep.
And so there are just so many things that combined to make journalism what it is today and to push, you know, people, push outlets increasingly toward point of view journalism and Ezra Klein and the cult of personality. Like, we've seen all these sort of things, and now, and people are just sort of confused now.
Sorry, you mean Ezra Klein has become a cult of personality?
No, Ezra Klein, I think, to me, was the one of the first examples. Yeah, I should maybe say all the words out loud.
Well, no, I agree with you. I mean, I think, you know, he built himself up as the product, and then it's dissipated since he has built Vox and there are other voices there. But he was certainly one of the early examples, you bet.
Oh, he absolutely was. And so that, to me, he was like the apex of personality-driven news.
Yep.
There was this sort of move toward, oh, well, if you've got a personality, you will build a whole brand around them.
Well, yeah, but there's Bill O'Reilly and there's Sean Hannity. I mean, there are guys on the right.
Sure, as well. Maybe just online.
No, Laura Ingraham now too, but yes, yeah, maybe online. Maybe that's it.
Like, Vox was literally constructed from the ground up around.
Right.
That's, you know, it's different than building a star on TV or something on broadcast. But it was like you constructed an entire media organization around this one guy.
Yeah,
like that. It was peak personality in some online. Anyway, it was a whole bunch of fascinating trends, and they have led in some ways, I think, to Pat Crane in Chicago, who has this to say about what to believe.
I used to think that I could tell bias in the news. I thought I was relatively savvy about picking up liberal and conservative biases in stories that were being reported. However, I later realized that the more subtle and powerful form of news bias is not the way that stories are being reported. It is which stories are getting reported. Stories can be found to reinforce any viewpoint, regardless of how fringe it is.
Yeah, it's also actually reported and repeated on social media, right? Because stories spread around, you know, Facebook and Twitter and all that jazz, right? And that is further amplification of the echo chamber, which is, you know, all of it's kind of a problem.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I'm gonna out my idea for my dream journalism
panel, which is
that I would like to get Dean Baquet, the executive editor in the New York Times, Jerry Baker, same position at the Wall Street Journal, and you know, the Washington Post guy. Why can't I think of his name right now?
Yeah, I don't know.
Marty Baron.
Yes.
In a room, and say to them, "Why are you letting your journalists be on Twitter?"
Ooh, really interesting.
Yeah, because one of the other things that, I mean, look, when you look at influencers and the way that news is disseminated and the echo chamber, what you have is a whole bunch of journalists on Twitter. And I have had editors, and when I worked at the New York Times, say to me, "Twitter is our assignment desk."
Really?
What does that mean? Like, what does that mean for our, you know, and they may say it sort of jokingly and they may mean it slightly metaphorically, but no, that's what's happening. Twitter is the assignment desk and all the news is the same. Except for the stuff that's just straight up made up. And then the stuff that's straight up becomes part of the mainstream narrative because you see it on Twitter.
Right.
Anyway, all of this is going on. It is all terrifying and, I don't know, exhausting. And it is all part of what I wanted to talk about Lydia Pohlgreen about at what they're doing at HuffPo, which is a very interesting mix of all of those things. In some ways. Yeah. Before we get to that conversation, though, let us know what you think about how these news outlets, these websites, these platforms are affecting you and what you think, because you probably still think it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can tweet us, ironically, at Kai Rizdahl and at Mollywood. Next up, Lydia Pohlgreen.
So, Molly, a couple of weeks ago, spoke at something called the Makers Conference here in Los Angeles. It's focused on women in business, change, and culture as well. And she sat down with Lydia Pohlgreen. She is the relatively new-ish editor-in-chief of HuffPost.
I see the headlines go by fast and quick. So, okay, we're on HuffPost, not HuffPo, HuffPost.
HuffPost,
So, I think we probably started our conversation talking about that. Like, what are you called now? Because it's hard to take over. She took over for Arianna Huffington, which is obviously no small feat, no small stilettos. I talked to her about just one of many of the big changes at HuffPost, because one of the things that it got known for was this contributor network, which was essentially allowing anybody to write for the site. And not get paid. So it had criticisms on lots of different sides. Lydia Pohlgreen said she took away. Lydia Pohlgreen, by the way, side note, came from the New York Times, in case nobody knows that. She took away posts that came from unpaid writers to focus on work from hired journalists. And she said that decision was really about how online media has evolved since HuffPost started.
the internet has changed a lot since 2005. It used to be that there were very few places where people could get their voices heard, and the HuffPost contributor platform was really revolutionary. Now we almost have the opposite problem. There are too many voices. There's cacophony, and it's hard to know what to pay attention to and what to tune out. So we really wanted to take ownership of our brand and of our editorial identity. And that is really a major identity shift for us and something that we're really excited about.
The contributor network was, of course, controversial because it involved unpaid contributors. But at the same time, you have, you know, these sort of curated spaces like Medium, building a business around that and amplifying a lot of different kinds of voices. Do you think there could have been a middle ground there?
I think that there are lots of really interesting platforms out there right now where people are able to express themselves. Tumblr, I think, which is part of the Oath family, is a really important one. Medium, you just spoke about. LinkedIn has become a really important publishing platform for a lot of people,
yeah,
particularly in the professional
so
world. I know. Who knew? I think a lot of folks are struggling to make a business out of it. I think that in this day and age where we're all talking about so-called fake news and we're all trying to be really responsible about what's factual and what's not, it seemed important that we really take ownership.
How do you see HuffPost's point of view?
Well, I like to think of our audience as, in really capacious terms, I like to think that we are there for anybody who earns a paycheck and lives on that paycheck. So a lot of the inspiration for me in thinking about what the voice and point of view of HuffPost is comes from some of the great urban tabloids of yesteryear. I think about the Daily News and the New York Post in their heyday, you know, working people's newspapers that you'd pick up for a nickel before you got on the subway. And for me, another source of inspiration was actually local TV news, because local TV news, and a lot of people really don't appreciate how important local TV news is to people's lives, but it really does provide that community glue and that sense of service. We did a bus tour last year where we visited 25 cities across the country. And a lot of those cities, when I was on the stops, I would go to the local TV network and you'd really get to the local TV station and you'd really get to see the deep connection that those stations have with their audience. And that idea of five on your side, we're here to help you. We're here to expose wrongdoing, but also, you know, tell you something fun that you should do with your kids this weekend. So those are really two very different, but I think complementary sources of inspiration for what I think the voice and identity of HuffPost is in its current iteration. Obviously, you know, Arianna Huffington was a really big personality. She's an extraordinary marketer and someone who has a lot of great who built an extraordinary brand. And I think that one of the testaments to a great company and a great founder is being able to take the DNA and give it a life beyond that person's identity. And so I've really tried to build on the things that I think are absolutely wonderful about HuffPost, but then also update the vision.
You know, people think of HuffPost as a liberal news site. How, if at all, is that a liability to you as you try to build that kind of, you know, five on your side brand?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because I think that we're living in hyper-partisan, hyper-polarized times, depending on who you ask. I also think that the old idea of right versus left, of liberal versus conservative, has really been overturned by the big political and economic forces of our time, globalization and technological change. The politics of globalization and the incredibly rapid pace in which the nature of work, the nature of wealth is changing, has really upended our traditional understanding of what is a conservative point of view and what is a liberal point of view. I mean, if you look at Brexit, you had people from the Conservative Party and from Labour on both sides of the issue in the UK. And that's because these questions about national identity, these questions about you know, who gets what, who gets to come into your country, they've really scrambled those traditional political poles. So I think that it's less about are you liberal or are you conservative than who you're for. And it really isn't about partisanship. It's about serving the reader and thinking about what their needs are.
Let's talk about the business model then around free and low-cost media, because that is a large conversation in the digital media world right now. You have a lot of air cover in the form of Verizon. I would argue that no force oppresses me more than Verizon, but that aside, you know, you have a lot of cover. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, Google and Facebook suck up 90% of the digital ad market. So how do you fight that?
There's no question that the landscape for ad-supported digital media is a challenging one. And I think that you're seeing the utter and complete decimation of traditional media companies. I think that there are lots of reasons to also feel optimistic that advertisers are skeptical about the dominance of Facebook and of Google, and are seeking a certain level of safety in being associated with reputable brands rather than just ending up algorithmically next to a piece of content that might be really, really unappealing or you know, disgusting or violent. And so I feel that we're actually in a really strong position to offer a very robust alternative to those other big platforms.
We are in the middle of this conversation about discourse and polarization and the role of either social media or fast-moving news online, and the part that it can play in that. How do you think that information can combat, I don't know, lack of knowledge or make discourse better?
I think that the best cure for hatred and ignorance is proximity and knowledge. And this was something that really came out with our bus tour was when you actually go into people's communities and you talk IRL, even about issues that are highly emotional, people tend to find common ground when they're face to face. And I think you're actually seeing that one-to-few connection is starting to be much more important than the one-to-many connection that really was the dominant thing in the earliest days of social media. The idea of broadcasting something on Twitter or broadcasting something on Facebook is, I think, really giving way to much more narrow casting and talking to smaller groups of people and having, I think, realer conversations in text chat, you know, text chains and groups in, among Instagram friends, which tend to be much smaller groups of people than you'd talk to on Twitter and other places. So I think that digital media has created this problem. There are ways that digital media can help solve these problems. And maybe one of those ways is by reducing its scale and making itself more human.
That sounds like a compromise in the business department, though, you know? How do you do that, but also have scale?
Scale isn't necessarily the answer to your revenue and monetization and business problems. I think that building real value and community and engagement is what advertisers are interested in now. And those are also things that lead you to other kinds of revenue models that are not necessarily mass scale based, right? So you need to be a certain size. But beyond that size, I'm actually not sure it really helps that much, unless you're a giant technology platform like Facebook or Google. But then you end up being accused of destroying democracy, and that's not so great either. So, I think there is a little bit of a Goldilocks situation, you know?
That's funny. I was just about to say, so you're looking to be Baby Bear. Just want to be right, just right.
Just right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Indeed.
Well, it's interesting. I'm so glad I'm not actually in charge of the business operations at a news organization today. It's, you know, up to and including Marketplace, right? I mean, it's tough. It's tough.
It is. It is. And there will always be kind of a large element of the tabloid part,
right?
If you are advertiser fund. You know, right. There's sort of, yeah. Like, that's a great argument to make if you're the information. I don't know if you know that site, but
yes.
It's a, you know, like a niche sort of technology news site with a really high subscription cost. Great. You only need a few thousand of those on a corporate expense account and you make all the money you need. But what if you're also free? It's just it's a fascinating thing to think about. And I think that was a conversation I could have for a lot more hours.
You asked her the Make Me Smart question, which, let's remember, what is something you thought you knew, but it turns out later you were wrong about? Here, once again, is Lydia Polgreen from The HuffPost.
You know, when we set off for this listening tour, we were going to visit 26 cities and talk to people all around the country. I assumed that everyone would want to talk about Donald Trump because I feel like every party that I go to, every day on Twitter, everybody on my Facebook feed, everybody's talking about Donald Trump. They hate him. They love him. They want him impeached. They think he should be dictator forever. Everybody has an opinion about Donald Trump. And over the course of this listening tour, we thought we were going to interview 500 people. We ended up interviewing close to 2,000, and almost no one mentioned Donald Trump. it was, at first I thought maybe this is like a Voldemort thing. Like nobody wants to speak his name because they're, you know, worried about whatever happens when Voldemort's name is spoken. Is this the moment when I confess I've never read Harry Potter?
It's cool. No, I was trying really hard not to tell you. Well, what happens is, no, please continue.
But I realized that the thing that we think is so important and that dominates our discourse, that I assume everyone is thinking about nonstop, which is, how did this person become president? You know, what does this mean for our country? And it's actually not true. There are just all these people who are out there living their lives. They're concerned about their schools. They're concerned about their health care. They're worried about jobs in their community. They're worried about clean water in their community. And at the end of the day, Donald Trump doesn't really play that big of a role in their lives. And that was a really interesting wake-up call. It was true of Democrats. It was true of Republicans. It was true of people of all different colors. And as someone who's in the news business, I really thought I knew that Donald Trump is the biggest and most important story in the lives of every single citizen of this country. And it turns out that's not the way people experience it. So, big lesson.
Yeah, it's totally true, right? I mean, I get home and I say to my wife, man, did you see this thing that happened today? And she's like, no, what? I mean, I got my own job, man. It's really funny. It's really funny.
I was thinking about that in the car the other day, and I was thinking, you know, if I really had to pinpoint, and I believe me, this is my privilege talking, but I thought if I had to pinpoint like the one thing that is actually driving me the craziest right now, it's middle school, and then it's like the fact that my right. Do Not Disturb doesn't work on, like, stupid iOS is still failing, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think, well, and I was, look, I was just in Montana with a bunch of my relatives who all have very different points of view, and none of that came up, ever. We talked about shooting mountain lions. Like, come on. There are more pressing concerns.
The Make Me Smart question is, what is something you thought you knew, but then you found out you were wrong about it? Record your answer to it on your phone. Email it to us, makemesmart@marketplace.org.
And more of your thoughts next, but first, we got to pay the bills.
All right, so here is where we hear from you.
Where do we mail a letter?
In the mailbox.
In the mailbox. We are still getting feedback from the interview I did back, like, beginning of March-ish with Tim Geithner, Ben Bernanke, and Hank Paulson. A lot of Make Me Smart listeners went online and listened to a whole thing. It runs about an hour. And one woman wrote from her perspective, working for one of the banks that was deemed too big to fail. In 2008, she says she was answering phones for the bank's service center. She still works for that bank, didn't want to say its name, but here's what she said.
Allison writes, what I want to know is that, of course, there are bad actors on Wall Street and poor decisions were made that led to the crisis. But the majority of employees are just scraping by like everyone else. My mortgage company failed, leaving me with a mess to clean up. My mortgage has been underwater for almost a decade. And even after graduating college and moving up on my job, my wages were stagnated for years. Without TARP, she said, it all would have been so much worse.
Yeah, well, that's why we're calling the project we're doing a Marketplace Divided Decade, right? Because that crisis is the foundational thing for the economy that we have today. Witness Allison and how much worse it could have been had Bernanke and Paulson and Geithner not done what they did.
Right.
Mike Wood writes this. I listened to the entire series of interviews with Ben, Hank, and Tim. I never did hear the right answer to the question. I never did hear the answer, rather, to the question, why did nobody go to jail? At one point, it was mentioned that an unspecified person gave Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac a clean bill of health right before they were taken over by the government. No follow-up was heard on what happened to that person either. So here's actually what happened in the room, Mike. Number one is, yes, there was a regulator for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac who did give Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac a clean bill of health right before they were nationalized. That person lost their job because the regulators changed and we created a new regulator for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Also, on the question of why nobody went to jail, I asked Tim Geithner this. I asked Henry Paulson this, Hank Paulson, in a conversation we had before that interview. And he said, you know, I get asked that question all the time. And my answer to public comment about that is, I'm not the Department of Justice. I was saving the economy. Really, the questions ought to be directed to Barack Obama's Justice Department, honestly.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, look, if you want to, yes, I have a whole toot on that and tracing everywhere we are now to no one going to jail.
Right.
A note from listener Dominique Henry that touches on our Make Me Smart theme of wages and inequality, which we talk about a lot on the show. She is interning to be a dietitian. She writes, I recently met with Arizona State Senator David Bradley, who asked me if it was common that dietetic interns, which I am, I didn't know that there was a word dietetic, typically don't get paid, while other interns, such as engineers, nurses, and pharmacy, do. I feel if interns have the abilities to apply knowledge in a supervised and unsupervised setting, they should be paid to support everyday living expenses.
Yes, they should. Marketplace interns get paid. I mean, yeah.
Also, totally. Diet leads directly to medical needs. Yeah. Like, it sort of feels like, why don't you pay? Anyway, if you're, yeah.
Yeah. We are still, Lou, these weeks later, still hearing from you about Facebook and data privacy because it is a story that is not going away. And one listener, I got a point that was made in last week's show about the users, looking after ourselves. I was probably the one making that point. Anyway, here it is. Just saying.
Hello, Molly and Kai. This is Jean-Claude from Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. What would it take for us to always remember that being part of any online networks makes us automatically keepers of our brothers and sisters' data? Thank you for making us all smart.
Yeah, it's kind of true, right? Keepers of your brothers and sisters' data. That's true. By the way, not for nothing, I lived in Ottawa for 2 years. Lovely town, froze my yayas off, can I just tell you?
Whew. Yeah. That's Canada for you.
Yeah.
That is a beautiful idea, though. It's sort of like, look, even if you don't care about your own data, just know that if you click that quiz, you might be turning over someone else's.
Totally.
Maybe that would help.
Yep.
I like that. Let's all be in it together. Good point, Jean-Claude. And that is it for us today.
Yes.
As I mentioned, I am on spring break, so we will have a proper news fix for you upon my return. But thanks for listening. And please tell us what you think now that we're back. We're like a few episodes in. What are we, a month in of our relaunch or our, I don't know, our return, our triumphant return.
Yeah. And triumphant return. Yes.
I was like, blowing the horns. Tell your friends about our show. Please subscribe. Please leave us reviews and let us know how we're doing. Please smash the like button, all of that. And we'll see you next week.
Man. All right. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Shara Morris, Christopher Olin, and senior producer Eve Tro. This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski. Our theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
There you go. Boom. 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 You doing something fun for spring break, by the way? What are you doing?
Yes.
What are you doing?
I'm going to Catalina Island. I'll be like in your hood.
Wow. Are you like whale watching and stuff?
Yeah. I'm letting like driving around in golf carts and junk.
Yeah, yeah. Get over on the other side away from whatever that town is.
Avalon?
Yeah. Yeah, that.
Oh, good to know. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it's lovely. It's nice.
Whale watching. Oh my God, we're totally doing that.
Cool. Excellent. All right. Bring your Dramamine because it can get a little choppy. Just saying.